On any given day, Cindy Gangram is at Ryerson Elementary School in Hamilton, teaching students like mine in the grade 6, 7, 8 class about such things as math and history and English and social justice and Gandhi, and she might also be dodging volleyballs in gym class. And then there were days like the one recently when she was in court in Toronto helping to take on the provincial government over its attempt to change health education curriculum in the vernacular, sex education, from the current 2015 incarnation to what was taught in the old days, that is, back in the 1990s. Welcome to The Message, a Hamilton Spectator weekly podcast. I'm John Wells, along with Aisha Nasser. This one is titled Schooling the Province on Sex Ed, and our guest is firebrand activist educator Cindy Gangram. The court challenge is just her latest crusade. Cindy is chair of the Board of Environment Hamilton, so climate change is also in her wheelhouse. Her background includes a political science degree and master's degree in labor studies from McMaster. And what I found in chatting with her recently is that her road to developing a passion for making difference started a long time ago. And here she is, Cindy.
Thank you so much for having me,
John. Well, thanks for coming in. So I want to talk a little bit about your road traveled, but first let me just jump right into the court case. Premier Doug Ford has said that he wants to change the health education curriculum back to what it was pre-2015, and you have been one of the leaders opposing that in court together with the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario. You were cross-examined on an affidavit you filed on the issue, and more recently the province's lawyer presented their case. So tell me, what happens now with the issue? Will the province succeed in changing the curriculum?
Well, that's a big question, so I'm going to take it in a few parts.
Sure.
So first off, yes, I was the co-applicant, or I am the co-applicant with the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario in this court matter, but there's really two matters that are before the courts right now with regards to the sex ed curriculum. The first matter was initiated by the Civil Liberties Association in August, and their concern is that the decision to repeal the 2015 curriculum and reinstate growth and development, which was originally released in 1998, mm-hmm. I'm just going to refer to them as the 98 and the 2015
sure.
for clarity. So the 98 curriculum was a necessarily unfair decision, that in doing so, several people who had felt represented no longer felt like there was a guarantee of their representation in sexual health education. The other part to the case, the part that's more connected to what I'm doing, is the idea that the way in which the directive, the decision to repeal the 2015 curriculum, the way in which it was delivered to the public, and teachers being part of the public, suggested to us that there were real limitations on how we could interpret the curriculum expectations and what we were allowed to teach. So, for example, something on healthy relationships that might be included in the 98 curriculum, perhaps in the years I used the 98 curriculum, I might have taken that all directions and talked about identities and orientations of all sorts. And now there was sort of this message coming out throughout the media that whether it was the press releases from the government or the articles being written based on their quotes that suggested that there were repercussions that would be faced should we teach the 2015 content. So where teachers felt like they might have taught certain ideas that they saw as being connected to the 1998 curriculum, now there was this idea that we might be reprimanded or get in some sort of trouble for doing so. And so that's really the basis of my court case. It's a challenge to my freedom of expression within that's protected under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The idea that teachers have freedom of expression in the classroom to uphold their professional and ethical obligations and to teach what they believe is right and is rooted in that curriculum. And so the concern that I have is that teachers feel a chill, and they feel that in doing so, and say teaching something like gender identity explicitly to their class, that they could get in trouble because of the directive that came out this summer. So my specific role in this court matter is advancing that position, the idea that I myself, as representative, well, as just a representative of me, really, mm-hmm. feel that I have experienced that chill, and it's encroached upon what I would ordinarily teach for the well-being of all my students.
Would that chill, I may be simplifying it too much, but would that chill, is it fair to say that you know, the upshot of something like that would be that if you're sort of feeling forced to teach the older curriculum, for example, that it restricts a teacher's ability to talk about gender issues and things like that that have come to the fore more, I suppose, for health education in the last several years, kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, from 1998, well, I began teaching in 2005. So from 2005 until 2015, I was teaching growth and development. And even though those ideas are not explicit to that growth and development curriculum, I knew that each year I would interpret it in the context of society. So as I understood more about gender identity and gender expression, that became part of how I interpreted the 98 curriculum. When the 2015 came out, it was very explicit in letting us teach those things, and not just letting us, but telling us that it was part of our expectation, that it was part of our curriculum. I think about grade 8 1.5 in under sexual health, which was explicitly teaching about gender identity. And so now it seems that even though I'm teaching a curriculum I taught in 2014, I don't feel that I can teach it as freely as I taught it in 2014 because of those, I'm going to call them, threatening statements by the government.
What do you say to someone, I'm trying to sort of, and perhaps I won't do a good job of it, but trying to capture the thread of opinion out there that perhaps the premier is advancing in essence, or, you know, that vein he's tapping of those who might argue that the way the health education curriculum has evolved, that it's gone too far, that kids in grade 6 shouldn't be learning about the things they are when it comes to gender identity or other issues of sexuality. I mean, that there is a population out there that believes that, and probably believes the premier is carrying the torch for them. I'm curious how you react to that.
Wow, that's a great question, and I certainly think that's a reality. So I feel like, first and foremost, as educators, I'm responsible for the well-being of all the students that I teach. And I think to myself that those students, they have all the protections and rights the Charter of Rights and Freedoms awards them and grants them, as well as everything the Human Rights Code guarantees as, you know, grounds in which there will not be discrimination and grounds in which there will be inclusion. And so I understand that people may have differing opinions on whether things are age appropriate or whether things are, you know, something they want shared with their children because it's counter to their own values. But I also think we have to remember that one of the roles of schools is to get our children ready to deal with the society as it is. And so my concern is that students, whether they're part of a marginalized community who needs to be understood, they're in need of really important and robust and valid current sexual health, but also students who might, if not given such education, be caught on the end of discrimination or default to certain patterns that in our society are now understood as not being fair or not being just. And so I think for the well-being of all society, we have to have a baseline of education that supports our Human Rights Code, that really upholds the values that our society enshrines legally, and makes sure that that's afforded to all students. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, the sidebar to that would be that I think that it's, for most of us educators who truly love our students, we want to see all of them feel like they're understood, and we want them all to feel loved and accepted at school. And I think that when a person has an identity that's not understood or accepted by the people around them, all sorts of good things that can come out of school are just, they can't happen. They can't feel included in gym class. They can't feel like they can be themselves. And I think that really that's what, losing track of your original question, what guides me through all of this and what I would respond to people who perhaps see that they're, you know, ethically in disagreement with what I'm doing would be that at the basis of all this is just love for all the students who deserve to be understood.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a fascinating issue, and I should say that on the message, on the link on the website, that the your affidavit that you wrote for the case is included as a link in the Spectator story that ran about you, so that we'll have that up there for people who want to read in more detail about the opinion you were advancing and that sort of thing. You know, I wanted to ask, you know, I know now after having interviewed you previously that you keep a crazy busy schedule.
Some weeks it feels a little crazy.
Some weeks, I mean, teaching alone is, you know, my mother was a teacher, and I know teachers, and they work awfully hard. But then you have this whole other, I'm sure you say connected thing, but this other, you know, the court case and other issues, social justice concerns that you get involved in and so on, and that you get involved in heavily, to put it mildly. So I want to ask, you know, what fuels that in you? What why are these matters, from the curriculum to climate change, equity issues, why are these things beyond academic or intellectual concerns for you? Why do you take these to heart and get involved so much?
Oh, I think the answer to that is so wide-ranging, but if I had to just take it right down to something small, I think I've always just cared for people, and I've always had the sense that all people deserve to feel loved and understood and accepted. And I really think that as a human, for the most part, all I really want, or all most of us really want, is just to feel loved and understood. And so if we start from the premise of people deserve to feel loved and understood, people need to feel loved and understood, then the next question becomes, that's our goal, how do we get there? And I think the way we get there is through constantly revising the patterns in society that perhaps make people feel a little less understood and a little less loved, and keep trying to course correct until we sort of create something that's a little bit kinder and gentler to everyone. And so with that in mind, I think that for me, I feel like since becoming a teacher, and I know it's strange because I've heard this before, you know, you're a teacher, you're so busy, why do you do these other things? Mm-hmm. But the strange irony of it is, it's being a teacher and being connected to such an incredible community of people that has really gotten me out to find these opportunities in which to participate and contribute. So in fact, like the board of directors at Environment Hamilton, it was a former parent that was instrumental in inviting me to come on board. So I feel like on the one hand, it's in line with all of my values, and it's also in line with why I wanted to be a teacher in the first place, but I also feel in a strange way that teaching has been a springboard for finding opportunities in the community where I can contribute. And I just feel like when given the opportunity, it's so important to take that opportunity and contribute, because I'm very, very privileged to have I feel like so many of us who care about issues want to do something and feel like we're contributing, and some people don't have an avenue or an obvious entry point to an avenue mm-hmm. in which they can contribute. So I actually feel that I'm very, very lucky, very blessed to get chances to participate, because they're ultimately so positive, and the people I meet are just incredible, like yourself.
We're going to have you back on for several more shows. So I wanted to ask about your road traveled a little bit, because I find it quite interesting. And I frankly wish we had a longer show with Cindy. But your parents are originally from Guyana, what was then called British Guyana,
yes.
as you pointed out to me. And they settled in Brampton. And that's where you were born and raised. And now you told me earlier that you know, your parents filled you as a young girl with a sense of self-worth and confidence. But that it wasn't long growing up that you sensed people treating you sometimes differently because of how you looked. So was that an education in human nature early on for you?
Oh, absolutely. My parents are two of the most incredible people that you'll ever have the opportunity to meet. Their resilience is just incredible. And I think as a child, you just kind of take for granted that these are the people who live in your home and that these are, you know, how everybody must be. And it's only through getting older that I realized just how incredible they are. So they were going out into a world every day where they may not have felt totally accepted, but they were still somehow coming home and instilling in us that we could do anything and that we had every opportunity in front of us. And I just think of them as so incredible for that. So I think that confident base became a very reassuring base, but then one that you said was easily disrupted when you found out that people, you started to discover in society that people are you know, perhaps not as accepting of you as you expected them to be.
Right.
And so Brampton in the late 70s, it's interesting because now we think of Brampton as this very diverse place, but in the late 70s, it just wasn't so in the early 80s, and that's when I was a little person there. And so it was really reflected in small instances of being treated differently and people making small comments to me that I sort of became aware that my skin color was a difference that really mattered to other people. And I always inherently felt like, I can't imagine why this is an issue. And I know how worthy and important I am. And so how could it be that you have a problem with me on something that seems so trivial? And so I think it made me realize perhaps the other things in society that one might feel inclined to judge about are trivial things that we shouldn't think about. So if skin color is something that I know doesn't define who I am in the sense that you shouldn't think of me as less because of it, what might society be encouraging us to think less of people for, and how might that be wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would guess I would say that in a way, I'm appreciative to have known what it feels like to be marginalized in some ways, because it allows me to use my points of privilege to try to help others who are marginalized, you know, understand that they're not alone and they are loved and respected.
I didn't have space in it in the story I wrote about you in the spec. But you have to tell the biting story.
Okay. Now, I know that's what I was thinking. I was dancing around that in my mind when you were just saying that.
You were just little, so.
That really was probably the very first incident when I ever really came to understand that somebody would have the inclination to make me feel very different because of my skin color. And I say different because I wasn't even put down. Later years, I remember people actually saying negative things about my skin color. But I recall that particular instance, it was just the emphasis of difference. So, okay, the story goes that it was a summertime and we lived in a townhouse complex and there was a fantastic little pool and kind of area that you could enjoy around the pool. And sunbathing was all the rage. And of course, my mom never did this, but I didn't question that. It was just something, you know, some families do things, some families don't do things. And so my good friend was out and she had one of those, you know, those little plastic lemons that you squeeze the lemon juice out of, and already that just looked glamorous. And then she was squeezing it into her hands and rubbing it on herself, and just looked like the most fantastic thing, and I wanted to take part. So I asked for some lemon juice and I was told no. And then I waited a minute and asked again, and I was told no.
By the little girl.
By the little girl, yeah. Yes. My friend.
Yes.
And I was told, no, you don't need it. No, you can't have it. You wouldn't use it. And it wasn't even these words. The words were just very implying that this was something I'm not giving to you because you have a difference that makes it so that this is not something for you.
Right.
And even though I realized that I didn't desire to make my skin darker and it wasn't something I had ever considered changing my skin color with the sun, it was the ritual that she was taking part in enjoying the summer day that I think was so appealing to me. So about the fourth no, each one becoming a little firmer than the last and seeming a little harsher, I don't know what came over me, because I really am a nonviolent human, but I did grab her arm and bit her with everything that I have, and stomped on home. And I went home and I didn't tell my mom about it, and I just proceeded to go about my day. And it wasn't long before there was a knock on the door, and the young person and her parent was at the door there to tell my mom that there were teeth marks and evidence that I had been slightly feral in my behavior. And I remember my mom always very concerned about our behavior. I expected to get into a huge amount of trouble. And I remember my mom speaking to me very gently about it and telling me it was unhygienic and it was very unsafe and that it could really hurt somebody. And it was only years later when I reflected on it that I realized she understood my feelings of injustice.
Yeah, she gave a very practical answer to why you shouldn't do that, but you understood the layers later on, I guess.
Yeah, and she was ultimately a nurse, so yes, you gotta always be careful about breaking the skin. And
you haven't bitten anyone since.
No. Yeah. And I think that urge might have left me with that great talk from my mom.
Right. No segue from that, but I talked about your academic resume, and you've read widely in history, philosophy, social theory. You were mentioning some philosophers who I had to Google quite extensively to figure out who they were. If you can meet one person, living or dead, for a coffee chat, say, who would that be?
Wow. I mean, the hard part about the question is that you have to choose one. And there's so many people all throughout history that I can only imagine how brilliant it would be to sit down and talk to them. And it's interesting. I think that a lot of people who, my students, would almost guess that my answer would be Gandhi in some ways. Just to understand how you grow up in so much privilege, but then you become, you know, concerned about how the world treats those who are marginalized. And I think that's interesting because sort of to connect back to the story we're telling, it was my recognition of some hardships that made me realize that I suppose that would be true for Gandhi too. So I guess if I had to pick one person, I suppose my first thought would be Gandhi. But of course there are, that's a very tough question. That's a very, very tough question.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
I also would love to talk to George R. R. Martin and ask him when his next book is coming out, but that's probably a more, not really the real purpose of having a coffee.
George Martin.
George R. R. Martin, my Game of the
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones writer, right. Yes. Yeah. And ask him if we are going to get that last book before the TV series.
I know you were a big fan.
It might be unhealthy.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, again, I didn't have space for this, but you are quick on your feet, your intellectual grounding, your passion for social issues, you know, which I suppose are all reasons that your union encouraged you to get involved in this current struggle and so on, be a figurehead of sorts for that. But would you ever entertain getting into politics, running for office, and taking your act to that stage?
Well, I mean, I would say no. I would say almost a hard no, except that it's not within my philosophies to say that I know how the future unfolds. But the way I feel right now, that's not something I'm really interested in. I feel like I've been very lucky to get to do what I love and do something that I believe in, which is teaching every day, and then extended from that, get to do things that allow me to feel like I'm giving back. I understand that, of course, you can give back immensely as a political leader. It's just not the type of giving back that I ever envisioned for myself. So I would have to say no, I don't really think about politics, and I certainly, when I do think about it, I don't think of it as something in my future.
Do you teach grade 6, 7, 8?
Yes.
How come you gravitated towards teaching young kids like that? I mean, you could have gone another route and been a professor in university or taught high school or all that, many other things. What is it about that appealed to you?
You flatter me. I don't know that I could do all those things. I was in an interesting middle school program in that it was like a run room schoolhouse a little bit, and we had the same teacher for 3 years, and there was always multiple grades in the classroom, and so that had been a very interesting and magical time insofar as learning never felt like it was something that was onerous, but it always felt like it was happening, and I just loved that time because all of a sudden you got to high school and realized how much your skills had expanded from the little grade 5 person you'd been. And so that's part of it for sure. But a larger part of it would be that when I was in grade 8, my brother passed away. He had a heart attack, and he was gone all within the same day. And that was a really difficult experience. We'd been very, very close. And in losing him, I realized that this is a time when we sometimes think of childhood as being so much fun. And I can remember being a little person and being told, oh, what do you have to worry about? You're a child. And I really realized that the concerns of children can be very real and very big and sometimes completely overwhelming, in that they don't have that same context to know that it will get better, things will change, this too shall pass. So I feel like a big part of why I wanted to be there was I thought, for all the kids going through the kinds of things, not necessarily losses, it can be a range of challenges. I remember what it felt like to be in grade 8 and to be having so many feelings and still feel like you're being treated as though you're just a kid with kid problems. And I remember feeling like a young adult. In fact, when people talk to me about adulthood, I always say my first memory of being an adult was sort of being in grade 8. And then each year you just got a little bigger and a little older. But really, there wasn't this one day when you said, whoa, I'm an adult now.
Right.
It was this gradual process. And so I feel like given that starts in grade 8, and or in middle school, I should really say, and that identity forming's happening, love and support becomes such an important part of what a child needs in their mentors. And so I felt like with that lens, and also with the fact that I want to foster academic habits at the youngest age possible, mm-hmm. It all drew me towards middle school.
Well, I've read some of the reviews from students online and parents, and they are big fans of yours. And so I think they're pretty lucky to have you as a teacher anyway. So
I'm very lucky to have so many amazing people be so supportive.
Cindy, I wish we had more time. We should do this again.
Yes.
And perhaps when the court case advances, we'll have another news peg to talk about. But thank you so much for coming in here after school with your schedule to be a guest on The Message.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we sign off, this is an occasional part of The Message podcast that we call One More Thing. And today, it is a significant and sad thing. Aisha, you told me the news this afternoon that the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Mary Oliver had died today at age 83. She died at her home in Florida from lymphoma, and that you are a big fan of her work.
Yeah, I was just, I work on the web team, so I was going through the wires, seeing what was happening all over the world. And when I read the news, it just hit me in a different way, because there was kind of like a comfort in knowing that she was alive and seeing, what was happening in the world and still processing that, and maybe, offering us comfort in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that comfort has been, has gone. So
And you followed her poetry over the years?
I did. ever since I've been reading poetry, I like her voice was one of the voices I would like look out for and actively being following. So
Well, on that note, you know, I think it's a great idea. Aisha had to close the program hearing the poet's voice. And so we'll sign off with that. And until next time, thanks for listening. And here are a few words from the legendary Mary Oliver.
I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?